when once the wheels fall into it, they are guided by it. Finally, if unattended, the rut becomes a small gully so great as to impede progress entirely. The mind works in precisely the same manner. One thought of a given subject makes only a slight impression on the brain. A repetition of that thought makes a deeper impression, and many repetitions make the impression so deep that it too becomes a mental rut into which the wheels of thought fall and operate automatically. If the gully is not stopped, it will in time become so serious that it will demoralize thought. Émile Coué had this principle of thought habit in mind when he admonished his followers to repeat, many times daily, his famous health and success formula, "Day by day, in every way, I am becoming better and better." To the person unfamiliar with the manner in which thought habits are formed, such a formula might seem useless, but not so with the person who understands how the power of thought operates. You will know when a habit has been properly established by your own state of mind and by the results you get from it. When the habit has been properly developed, you will experience a feeling of continuous enthusiasm in connection with your plans. This enthusiasm will drive you during your every conscious moment. It will even continue driving you through your subconscious mind while you sleep. And you need not be surprised when your subconscious mind awakens you from sleep with some idea or plan useful in carrying out the object of your definite major purpose. Work will no longer be a drudge. It will be a pleasure in which you will engage as eagerly as you eat your meals when hungry. Moreover, things will begin to happen outside your own mind that will give you courage. People will begin to cooperate with you in a spirit of enthusiasm. Unexpected opportunities for the promotion of your personal interests and plans will spring up all around you. Your imagination will become keener and more active. You can work long hours without becoming fatigued. You will experience better health than you ever had before. Gradually, the dark glasses of despair you have been wearing will change their color, and you will see the whole world around you through crystal clear glasses of hope and faith. For you will have changed the entire vibration of your being, and with this change will come an improvement in your financial, social, and occupational status. This is no idle promise. I know it will be realized by you if you follow instructions, because it has happened to thousands of other students of this philosophy. Defeat may overtake you, as it overtakes everyone, but you will use it as a challenge to greater effort because you will have discovered that organized thought is an irresistible force capable of making stepping stones out of stumbling blocks. How, may I ask, could anyone be permanently defeated who has acquired the ability to transmute every emotion, every feeling, every fear, and every worry into a constructive, positive, driving force for the attainment of definite ends? And this is precisely what organized thought enables one to do. Every student of this philosophy should have the word action burned into his consciousness, for it is one of the key words of the entire philosophy. Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie's views on organized thinking. This interview took place in Mr. Carnegie's private study more than 30 years ago, while the great steel master was coaching his protege, Napoleon Hill, in preparation for the organization of the Philosophy of American Achievement. Hill. You have explained that an important principle of individual achievement is organized thought. You have stated also that no one may be sure of success without the ability to organize his thinking habits. Therefore, will you go ahead, Mr. Carnegie, and explain the meaning of the term organized thought? I have a general idea what it means, but I would like to have a detailed statement of its meaning, also a clear understanding of how this principle is applied in the practical affairs of life. Carnegie. Before discussing the organization of thought, let us examine thought itself. What is thought? With what do we think? Is thought subject to individual control? Thought is a form of energy that is distributed through the brain but it has one peculiar quality unknown in connection with all other forms of energy. It has intelligence. Thought can be controlled and directed toward the attainment of anything man may desire. In fact, thought is the only thing over which any person has complete unchallenged control. The system of control is so complete that no one may penetrate the mind of another without his consent, although this system of protection often is so loosely guarded that one's mind may be entered at will by any person skilled in the art of thought interpretation. Many people not only leave their minds wide open for others to enter and interpret their thoughts, but they voluntarily disclose the nature of their thoughts by unguarded expressions of speech and their personal conduct, their facial expression, and the like. Hill, is it safe for one to leave his mind open to free entry by others? Carnegie, just about as safe as leaving the door to one's house unlocked, with all of one's valuables left inside the house, except that the loss of purely material things is as nothing compared with the loss one may suffer by leaving his mind open to entry by any stray tramp who may wish to go in and take possession. You see, the habit of leaving one's mind open and unguarded not only permits other people to enter and become familiar with one's most private thoughts, but this habit permits all sorts of tramp thoughts released from the minds of others to enter one's mind. Hill, you believe, then, that thoughts do pass from one mind to another? Carnegie, yes, one's mind is being constantly bombarded with the impulses of thought released from the minds of others, especially those with whom we come into close contact daily. One negative-minded workman, if left to associate with other workmen, will pass on his negative thoughts to every other person within the range of his influence, although he never speaks a word or makes a single move indicating his state of mind. I have seen this very thing happen so often that I could not be mistaken about it. Hill, and that is why you emphasize so strongly the necessity of harmony between men associated in a mastermind alliance? Carnegie, that is one of the major reasons why I have emphasized the importance of harmony. The chemistry of the brain is such that the mind power of a group of men can be organized so it functions as one unit of power only when there is perfect rapport between the minds of the individuals. Hill, one of the important steps in organized thought seems to be that of the Mastermind Alliance, through which men pool their mind power, their experience, education, and knowledge, and move in response to a common motive. Is this the right idea, Mr. Carnegie? Carnegie, you have stated the matter perfectly. You might have said that the Mastermind Alliance is the most important step one may take in connection with organized thought, for that is true. But organized thought begins with the organization of the individual's thinking habits. To become an effective member of a mastermind alliance, an individual must first form definite, controlled habits of thought. A group of men working together under the mastermind principle, each of whom has so disciplined himself that he controls his thought habits, represents organized thought of the highest order. As a matter of fact, there never can be full assurance of harmony in a mastermind group unless each member of the group is so self-disciplined that he can control his own thoughts. Hill, do I understand you to say that an individual may actually discipline himself so that he controls the nature of his thoughts? Carnegie, yes, that is true. But remember that one gains control over his thoughts by forming definite thought habits. You know, of course, that when habits are once formed, they function automatically, without any voluntary effort on the individual's part. Hill, but Mr. Carnegie, isn't it very difficult for one to force his mind to function through definite habits? How may one go about this sort of self-discipline? Carnegie, no, there is nothing difficult about the formation of habits. As a matter of fact, the mind is constantly forming thought habits without the conscious knowledge of the individual, responding, as the mind does, to every influence that reaches it from one's daily environment. Through self-discipline, one may switch the action of his mind from responses to the casual influences around him to subjects of his own choice instead. This is accomplished by setting up in the mind a definite motive based on a definite purpose and intensifying that purpose until it becomes an obsession. Stating the matter differently, one may fill his mind with a definite purpose that is so interesting it leaves him no time or opportunity to dwell upon other subjects. In this manner, he forms definite thought habits. The mind responds to whatever stimuli one feeds it. When a man is driven by a strong desire to achieve success in any given direction, his mind responds to that desire and forms definite thought habits connected with the attainment of that desire. Hill. Then organized thought begins with definiteness of purpose. Carnegie. Everything man achieves begins with definiteness of purpose. Name a single instance, if you can, where a man has achieved any form of success without a definite motive, based on a definite purpose, carried out through a definite plan. But you must remember that there is one more factor that must be considered in connection with definiteness of purpose. The purpose must be expressed in terms of intense action. Here is where the power of the emotions gives an account of itself. The emotional feeling of desire for the attainment of a definite purpose is the power that gives life and action to that purpose and influences one to move on his own initiative. To ensure satisfactory results, one's definite purpose should be given obsessional proportions. It should be backed by a burning desire for its attainment. Desires of this sort take full possession of one's mind and keep it so fully occupied that it has no inclination or opportunity to entertain stray thoughts released by the minds of others. Hill. I believe I see what you mean. For example, a young man who is in love has no difficulty in keeping his mind on the object of his love, and not infrequently does his mind work out ways and means of inducing a response to his affections from the woman of his choice. In this sort of circumstance, one has no difficulty in forming controlled thought habits. Carnegie, your illustration is perfect. Now, switch it over to some other sort of purpose, such, for example, as the development of a business or a profession, or the attainment of a definite position, or the accumulation of money, and you will have an idea of how these ends are attained through obsessional desire for their attainment. Hill, but Mr. Carnegie, one usually cannot put the same sort of emotional desire into the attainment of material things that he experiences in his love for the woman of his choice. Carnegie, no, of course not. But there are other emotions with which he can stimulate his desire for material things. Study the 9 basic motives, and you will observe that any sort of a desire is emotional in its nature. There is the desire for material riches, and it is a rather universal and well-developed desire with most people. The desire for personal expression leading to recognition and fame, the desire for self-preservation, and the desire for freedom of body and mind. All of one's emotions, including, of course, the emotion of love, can be converted to the attainment of any desired end. The desire for the accumulation of material riches may, for example, be combined with one's love for the woman of his choice, where the desire for money is associated with one's desire to provide the woman of his choice with the comforts that money will buy. In such a circumstance, one would have a double motive for the accumulation of money. Hill. Oh, yes, I see what you mean. As a matter of fact, one might be influenced by all of the 7 positive motives as a driving force behind one's major purpose in life, could he not? Carnegie. Yes, by the 7 positive motives and, through transmutation of emotion, by the 2 negative motives as well. You know, of course, that any emotion, whether positive or negative, may become an inspiration to action that can be directed to the attainment of any desired end. The motive of fear, for example, often serves as a powerful inspiration to action. To benefit by it, one has only to control his action habits until those habits become automatic. Hill. Do you mean that habits function voluntarily, without any effort on the part of an individual? Carnegie. Yes, that is exactly what any habit does when it becomes fixed. Hill. You say, when it becomes fixed? What fixes a habit? Must an individual do that? And if so, how does he proceed to make a habit permanent? Carnegie. Habits become fixed by some unknown law of nature, which causes the impulses of thought to be taken over by the subconscious mind and voluntarily carried out. This law does not make habits, it only fixes them, so they operate automatically. The individual begins a habit by repeating a thought or a physical act. After a time, depending upon the emotional feeling that goes into the thought, one's thought habits are taken over and followed voluntarily. Hill. Then the formation of habits is something an individual may control? Carnegie. Oh, yes. And may I remind you that the control of habit forming is an important part of organized thinking? You see, an individual may set up any sort of habits he chooses, go through them for a while, very much in the same manner that one would go through with a physical culture sitting up exercise, after which the habits will become automatically perpetuated without his conscious attention to them. Hill. And you say that some unknown law of nature fixes one's habits so they perpetuate themselves? Carnegie. Yes, that is an established fact. It is one of the most important facts in the entire field of mental phenomena, for it is literally the medium by which an individual may take possession of his own mind. The man who uncovers the secret by which nature fixes man's habits will have made a stupendous contribution to science, a greater contribution, perhaps, than that made by Newton, who discovered the law of gravitation. Perhaps when the discovery is made, if it ever is made, it will be revealed that the law which fixes men's habits and the law of gravitation are closely related, if not actually one and the same. Hill. Your hypothesis intrigues me, Mr. Carnegie. Could you elaborate upon it? Carnegie. All we know definitely about habit is the fact that any thought or physical act that is repeated tends to become perpetuated through some force which carries on the habit automatically. We know that habits can be changed, modified, or eliminated altogether by the simple process of voluntarily adopting opposing habits of a stronger nature. For example, the habit of procrastination, a habit with which everyone is more or less afflicted, can be mastered by setting up definite habits of prompt initiative, based on a sufficiently strong motive to ensure the new habits a dominating influence in the mind until they become automatic in their operation. Thus, you see that motive and habit are twin brothers. Almost every habit one adopts voluntarily is the result of a definite motive or purpose. You see, therefore, that one may establish any habit he desires, or eliminate any undesirable habit, by applying enough self-discipline to fix his habits until they become automatic. If habits are not fixed voluntarily, they develop without one's conscious help. It is in this manner that most undesirable habits are formed. Hill. It is obvious, then, that the principle of self-discipline is a necessary tool in the formation of habits one deliberately forms? Carnegie. Yes, self-discipline and organized thinking are almost synonymous terms. There can be no organized thinking without strict self-discipline, for after all, organized thought is nothing but carefully chosen thought. Thought habits can be established only through strict self-discipline. Motive or obsessional desire makes self-discipline very easy. It is no trouble at all to form thought habits if one has a definite motive backed by a strong emotional desire for the attainment of the object of the motive. Hill. Do you mean that it is easy for one to form thought habits in connection with subjects in which one has a keen personal interest? Carnegie. That's the idea exactly. The procrastinator drifts through life a failure because he has no obsessional motive for doing anything in particular. His thinking is not organized because he has chosen no specific calling for organized planning. Hill. Mr. Carnegie, will you briefly describe the major benefits of organized thinking from the viewpoint of the man who wishes to make the best use of his time and ability? Carnegie. The benefits are so numerous that it is difficult to decide where to begin or where to stop, but these are some of the more obvious advantages of this habit. A. Organized thinking enables one to become the master of his own mind. This he accomplishes by training his faculty of will to control his emotions, turning them on and off as occasion may require. B. Organized thinking forces one to work with definiteness of purpose, thereby enabling him to set up a habit that prohibits procrastination. C. It develops the habit of working with definite plans instead of blundering ahead by the hit-or-miss method. D. It enables one to stimulate the subconscious mind to greater action and more ready response in the attainment of desired ends, instead of allowing the subconscious mind to respond to the tramp thoughts and destructive influences of one's environment. E. It develops self-reliance. F. It gives one the benefit of the knowledge, experience, and education of others through the medium of the Mastermind Alliance, which is an important medium used by all able thinkers. G. It enables one to convert his efforts into greater material resources and larger income, since an organized mind can produce more than one that is not organized. H. It develops the habit of accurate analysis, through which one may find the solution to his problems instead of worrying over them. I. It aids in maintaining sound health, because mind power that is organized and directed toward the attainment of desirable ends has no time to be wasted in connection with self-pity or imaginary ailments. Idle minds tend to develop ailing bodies. J. Last, but by no means least, organized thinking leads to peace of mind and that form of permanent happiness which is known only to the man who keeps his mind fully occupied. No one can be either happy or successful without a planned program for the use of his time. Planned programs are based on organized thinking. As I have stated before, the brain is something like a rich garden spot in that it will voluntarily grow a fine crop of weeds if it is not organized and kept busy growing a more desirable crop. The weeds are represented by the stray thoughts that take possession of the unorganized, idle mind as the result of one's daily environment. Study the list of benefits carefully, and you will reach the conclusion that any one of them offers sufficient reward to justify all the effort one puts into organizing his thinking habits. The sum total of all these benefits represents the difference between success and failure. Success is always the result of an ordered life. An ordered life comes through organized thinking and carefully controlled habits. Hill, I take it, from what you have said, that work and organized thinking are essentially related. Carnegie, nothing can take the place of work as a part of organized thinking. You see, work is thought power translated into physical action. Organized thinking can never be relied upon to become a habit until it is expressed in some form of action. Hill, you have stated that organized thinking begins with the adoption of a definite purpose, that the purpose must be followed by a plan expressed in action until the action becomes a habit. Now, will you state whether or not one may work as effectively in expressing a plan of action in connection with some form of labor he does not like to perform as he can if he performs work that he likes? Carnegie, a man will always be more effective when engaged in the sort of work he likes best. That is why one's major purpose in life should be of his own choice. People who drift through life performing work they do not like merely because they must have an income as a means of living, seldom get more than a living from their labor. You see, this sort of labor does not inspire one to perform service in an obsessional desire to work. It is one of the tragedies of civilization that we have not found a way to give every man the sort of work he likes best to do. That sort of work is never a drudgery. Hill, then it would be proper to say that organized thinking can best be done when a man moves with a definite motive in the performance of work of his own choice under conditions that inspire him to make his work an obsessional desire? Carnegie, that would be one way of stating the matter. You will observe, as you begin to analyze men who succeed and those who fail, that the successful men always are engaged in work they like to perform. Hours mean nothing to them. They consider the joy of their labor to be an important part, perhaps the most important part, of their compensation. Hill. Do you think the time will ever come when ordered society will find ways and means of aiding everyone to do that which he likes best to do? Carnegie. Yes, I think that time will come, because that sort of a system would be not only economical, but it would do away with much of the misunderstanding that now prevails between employers and employees. The man who is engaged in work of his own choice is worth much more than the man who performs work that he does not like, no matter what the wage scale may be. Hill. Isn't it the responsibility of the employers to find a way to assign all workmen to the sort of work they like best? Carnegie. Perhaps it is, but our present system of industry does not always make this an easy matter. You see, there are only a certain number of jobs of each class of work to be performed in a business or industry, and generally the ones men like best to do are those of which there are the fewest number. The solution of this problem will call for an improved system of employment, one that will enable an employer to select men who are suited for each particular job with reference to their native ability, training, and preference for jobs. It will also call for a different system of compensation, a system that will give men an opportunity to earn more money when performing work that is less desirable, thereby establishing a motive for their putting more into such work. Hill. I can see that the analysis of this subject leads one immediately into deep water. It seems that the solution of the problem will have to begin while the individual is being educated, through a system that will prepare him to perform work of his own choice. Then, all educational institutions should coordinate their efforts in such a manner that they would not turn out too many men for some types of work and too few for other types. This would require a periodic survey of industry, business, and the professions to enable educational institutions to determine how many men of each classification could be absorbed in employment. Carnegie. Yes, the system would have to be conducted in some such manner. Right now, for example, the schools are turning out doctors, teachers, and lawyers in greater numbers than are needed in these fields, with the result that some of the members of these professions have a hard time making a living. Hill. I take it from your analysis that organized thinking should begin with those engaged in educational work and those who manage industry and business. Carnegie. Yes, that is one place where it should begin, but do not overlook the fact that the habit of organized thinking is also an individual responsibility, and the individual who overlooks it must accept from life whatever he can get. The better things of life go always to men who form habits of organized thinking. It has always been this way. It always will be. Thinking constructively is one responsibility which no one can delegate to another. It is an individual responsibility. Hill. Granted, Mr. Carnegie, that organized thinking is an individual responsibility, there must be a starting point from which one begins to acquire the ability to organize his thinking, and at least a few simple rules by which one may be guided in this business of organizing his thoughts. Could you name some of the rules? Carnegie. Well, the first thing one must recognize, in order to become an accurate thinker, is the known fact that the power with which we think is mental dynamite that can be organized and used constructively for the attainment of definite ends, but if it is not organized and used, through controlled habits, it may become a mental explosive that will literally blast one's hopes of achievement and lead to inevitable failure. Stating the matter in another way, one should recognize that the power of thought is probably a projected portion of infinite intelligence, but every individual has been given the privilege of appropriating and using this power for the attainment of ends of his own choice. That the medium of appropriation and control is voluntary habits. One cannot control infinite intelligence, but one can control his own mental and physical habits. Thus, indirectly, he may appropriate and use infinite intelligence, because infinite intelligence fixes one's habits and makes them permanent and automatic in their operation. Next, the accurate thinker must learn how to avail himself of reliable sources of information, where to obtain dependable facts, which he will need in connection with organized thinking. Guesswork and hopeful wishing, the most common sources of information to a majority of the people, can never be relied upon to supplant accurate sources of facts. Here is where the mastermind principle becomes indispensable, as it enables one to supplement his own stock of knowledge with the knowledge, education, experience, and native ability of all others with whom he has a mastermind alliance. If one chooses his mastermind allies wisely, as most successful business and industrial leaders choose theirs, one may have at his command the most reliable sources of knowledge that schooling and human experience have to offer. Thus, in his business of thinking, planning, and organizing, he has not merely his own brain to guide him, but the brains of each member of his mastermind alliance. There is no escape from the fact that the formation of a mastermind alliance is one of the most important major steps one must take in order to organize his thinking, evidence of which may be found in the fact that all successful people are allied, in one way or another, with others whose knowledge they use freely. Without such an alliance, there can be no such reality as effectively organized thinking. And this for the reason that one brain, no matter how capable it may be, is never complete by itself. When we speak of a man's wife as his better half, we generally express much more of the truth than we realize, for it is a well-known fact that no man's mind is complete without a harmonious alliance with the mind of a woman. Therefore, every man should include at least one woman in his mastermind alliance. When the minds of male and female are combined, or blended, in a spirit of harmony, the alliance tunes in and appropriates a much greater proportion of that force which we call spiritual power than either can appropriate when operating independently. The man who overlooks this truth will suffer an irreparable loss of potential mind power, as there is nothing that can take the place of spiritual power. Now, I cannot tell you what spiritual power really is, but I assume that it is simply a greater volume of infinite intelligence than that which is available where the feeling we describe as spiritual is not present. There are certain emotions which lift one into this exalted feeling, such as the emotion of love and the emotion of faith. While one's mind is stimulated by this exalted feeling, the faculty of the imagination becomes more alert. One's words take on a magnetic influence that makes them impressive. Fear and self-limitation disappear, and one dares to undertake tasks he would not think of beginning when his mind is stimulated only by the purely mental processes of enthusiasm and desire. Hill, do you mean, Mr. Carnegie, that one may so relate himself to others under the mastermind principle that he may lift himself above the ordinary processes of mental operation of the mind and place himself under the guiding influence of that power known as spiritual? And this, too, is a part of organized thinking? Carnegie, I mean precisely that. The term organized thinking means everything the two words connote, that is, thinking based on every known advantage, every known mind stimulant, every known source of accurate knowledge, and the highest form of ability, whether it be native ability or acquired ability, whether it be individual ability or the ability available to one through the minds of others. Hill, pardon my seeming facetiousness, but I take it from what you have just said that a man who is highly skilled as an organized thinker is a sort of Superman. Carnegie, to be candid, you are correct. And I am glad to know that you have at last caught the full significance of what I have been trying to tell you, namely, that the power of thought is an irresistible force, that it has no limitations save those set up by the individual, either by his lack of understanding of the possibilities of thought power, or lack of knowledge as to how to organize, appropriate, and supply this power. Hill, what about the man who acquires great knowledge in connection with organized thinking, but uses his power unfairly to gain advantage over others? Is there not a danger in teaching men how to become supermen, in view of the fact that some men have great capacity to use their minds, but lack a well-grounded sense of moral obligation to others? Carnegie. An all-wise Creator has provided for such a circumstance, evidence of which may be found in the fact that the man who uses his mind power to damage or destroy others soon eliminates himself by the loss of his power, and the Creator has also very wisely provided that this sort of power is something that cannot be passed on from one to another. Go back into history and examine the records of those who have undertaken to become world conquerors, and observe what happened to them. Nero, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar, Napoleon Bonaparte, and others of similar determination made great strides toward world domination. But look what happened to them and their achievements. Not one of them accomplished his aim. Not one of them passed on to his followers any means by which his gains could be maintained. But these selfish leaders did pass on to their followers a curse that wiped out all the gains they made. Apply the principle anywhere you choose, at any period of civilization, and observe that the effect is the same. Only the gains of men who used their mind power beneficially have been preserved. Study the gains made by the Nazarene, for example, and observe that although they were infinitesimal during his lifetime, they have lived and spread down through 19 centuries until the influence of Christianity is now a recognized force in every part of the world. Give yourself no worry over the man who uses his mind power for the detriment of others, for he has fixed his own destiny by the nature of his deeds. If he is not cut down sooner, he will be wiped out within the accepted 70 years of average age that men live. The trend of civilization is upward, and though the line may zigzag upward and downward at given periods, it moves eternally upward as a whole. Wise men recognize this truth and adapt themselves to it. Hill. I agree with what you have said, Mr. Carnegie, but there are so few wise men. The world seems populated with too many who either fail to recognize the advantages of relating themselves to others helpfully, or grossly neglect to do so, believing, no doubt, that they are smart enough to make their own rules of life and get by with them. What should be done with or for such people? Should they not be either taught or forcefully made to conform to the rules of decent human relationship? Carnegie. Yes, they are forced to conform to a certain extent. Practically every man-made law that exists is evidence of the recognition of the need of a means of restraint. If everyone understood and respected the laws of nature, there would be no need for man-made laws. But force is not enough to bring men into an understanding of the laws of nature. Education is also necessary. That is why you were chosen to organize the philosophy of American achievement. In this philosophy, you have the necessary motives and inducements, in the form of promise of individual benefits, to influence people to apply the philosophy voluntarily and of their own free will. This sort of effort is far superior to that which is produced through force. Men do best that which they wish to do. Hill. Oh, I see what you mean. It is better to teach a person to adapt himself to rules of human relationship that are beneficial to others as well as himself than it is to force him to do so. Is that your idea? Carnegie. That is the idea exactly. In rearing children, for example, it is far better to induce a child to wish to do something than it is to use force. Parents who understand this psychology manage their children by directing their interests to things that are helpful to them and not objectionable to others, rather than by forcing them to refrain from doing objectionable things. In a sense, we adults are only little children, and we do best that which we have been influenced to wish to do. We also resent being forced to do or to refrain from doing anything. This is an inherent part of human nature. It is a part of everyone, of all ages. Everyone likes freedom to act on his own initiative. Destroy this freedom, and you retard the mental and spiritual growth of the individual. You might say also that you destroy economic and financial achievements the moment you destroy the desire for personal initiative. It is a recognized fact that the people of the United States enjoy the highest standard of living known in the history of the world, With this known fact, consider also the fact that the American people are distinguished because of their natural inclination to become self-determining, and the further fact that we have more personal freedom than any other people have had. The whole system of free enterprise under the American way of life is the nearest approach to adaptation to nature's plan for the growth of man through self-effort that the world has ever known. Hill. Then organized thinking and the privilege of free, unmodified, personal initiative are closely related, are they not? Carnegie. You have the right idea. Organized thought must be followed by expression through organized plans of action. One does not grow mentally or spiritually by passive thought alone. Growth is the result of thought expressed through voluntarily developed and definitely controlled habits of action. Hill. And that is why the man with practical experience in the application of any form of theoretical knowledge has more ability than the man who has only the theory, is it not, Mr. Carnegie? Carnegie. You have hit the nail squarely on the head. Ability, in its most effective form, is based upon sound theory expressed in definitely organized forms of action. That is why most college graduates have to acquire practical experience in the application of the knowledge gained from their schooling before they become efficient. Hill. Would you say, then, that organized thinking is a combination of knowledge and organized action in the expression of knowledge? Carnegie. I would say precisely that. Knowledge has no value whatsoever unless and until it is expressed in terms of organized action. This explains why the man with nothing but book learning is seldom practical in the application of knowledge gained from books alone. Hill. But book learning is helpful, is it not? Carnegie. Yes, book learning is essential as a foundation of education, but remember that it is only a foundation. An educated person is one who has so developed his mind through a combination of knowledge and the expression of knowledge that he can reshape any set of circumstances to meet the requirements of his desires. That sort of ability consists of both theory and practice, mostly the latter. A man might read every book ever written on engineering, yet he would be unable to lay out a plan and build a bridge until he had combined his theoretical knowledge with practical experience. Of course, he could build a bridge on theory alone, but there would be no assurance that it would stand under any given weight. Practical engineers know precisely how much weight a bridge will carry, and they know how to supervise the building of such a bridge so it can be depended upon. Hill. Could a man become an able salesman by reading alone? Carnegie. The principle of combining theory with practice applies the same to salesmanship as to the building of bridges or anything else. The principle is fundamental, therefore it is an essential part of organized thinking. A man does not become an able lawyer or dentist or doctor by merely acquiring a degree in these professions. He becomes able by applying the theory he learns in school in the practical field of experience, and in no other way. There is no school that equals the good old university of experience, and this is one school in which cribbing is not possible. One either graduates on merit, or one does not graduate at all. Cheating is impossible, and the teacher is the individual himself. When a man enters the university of experience, he stands at last in front of one counter on which the merchandise is plainly marked, and he is both the salesman and the purchaser. If he gets the merchandise he desires, he pays the price that life has placed upon it. Hill. From all you have said on the subject of organized thinking, Mr. Carnegie, I reach the conclusion that skill is developed in this art, first, by coordination between the faculties of the mind and the physical body through definitely controlled habits, and second, by coordination with one's associates under the mastermind principle for the attainment of definite objectives. Carnegie. You have come pretty near to describing the modus operandi of organized thinking. But you should have emphasized one thing you omitted, the necessity of action. You are correct in stating that organized thinking begins by coordination between the faculties of the mind and the physical means of expressing thought, but do not forget that skill and perfection are attained only by highly developed and definitely controlled habits of action. I have repeated this idea over and over again, not that I do not believe you understand it, but for the reason that I know, from association with thousands of men, how long it requires to get one to become aware of the importance of this point. Unless a man becomes action-conscious, he will never become an organized thinker. He may think from morning until night, but unless he puts his thoughts into action, he will be nothing but a daydreamer. He may theorize, but he will never learn to build a bridge or perform any sort of practical service. Right here is where many people deceive themselves into believing that they are thinkers. I have heard not a few men say, "I have been thinking of doing this or that, but so far I have found no way to do it." Now, what is the trouble with such men? They have left out of their thinking one important factor, and that is physical action. If you wish to do something, start right where you stand and begin doing it now. What, you may ask, shall I use for tools? Where will I get the capital? Who will help me? And I shall reply that men who accomplish anything worthy of mention always begin before everything they need is in hand. I have never yet been entirely ready for anything I have begun, and I doubt if anyone else ever has been. It is one of the strange phenomena of human experience that the man who begins where he stands and does the best he can with whatever means he may have very soon finds other and better means of accomplishing his objectives. Mysteriously, the tools are placed at his disposal. This question of one's not being ready usually is nothing but an excuse with which he deceives himself. You were not ready to begin organizing the world's first practical philosophy of individual achievement. You needed more schooling. You needed a monetary subsidy to carry you through 20 years of profitless research. You needed age and maturity of thought, and you needed practical experience in many different fields of endeavor. Yes, you needed all these things, and many more, before presenting the world with a dependable philosophy of achievement. But what did you do when I gave you your opportunity to organize such a philosophy? I'll tell you what you did. Within 29 seconds of the time that I gave you the opportunity, you grabbed it and went to work on it, and I would stake my life that nothing but death could stop you from finishing the job. Men who start where they stand, when they wish to do something, usually find a way of finishing that which they undertake. I keep a watch in my desk for the sole purpose of timing men's reactions to ideas and opportunities. That watch has ticked off the destiny of hundreds of men to whom I have given opportunities for self-advancement. The watch never lies. It tells exactly how long it takes a man to make up his mind when he has all the necessary information before him to enable him to reach a decision. It tells precisely how much action consciousness a man has. Your reaction time was 29 seconds. You had 31 seconds still to go when you reached a decision and embraced the opportunity I gave you. If you had gone 31 seconds longer, you would have lost your chance, for, as I have told you before, I had allowed you only 60 seconds in which to say yes or no. I purposely keyed up the requirements, in your case, by allowing you only a brief time in which to decide. This was done because of the tremendous amount of sticking qualities needed to do the sort of job I had laid out for you. I have learned from experience that a man's endurance or sticking qualities can be measured in exact ratio to his reaction time in making up his mind to undertake a job. Hill, from your remarks, I conclude that organized thinking calls for definiteness of decision as well as action. Carnegie, that's the idea. Life is short, at best. Time flies in a hurry. An important part of self-discipline is that of developing the habit of quick and definite decisions, always, on every subject. The man who hesitates, when he has all the necessary information before him to enable him to reach a decision, will never get anywhere. He will find himself outmoded by faster thinkers. Right here, you will find one of the major differences between men who succeed and men who fail. The man who succeeds often has less ability, less education, less experience than the man who fails, but he has more action consciousness. Hill. As I listen to what you say, Mr. Carnegie, I am impressed more and more with the thought that success is more a matter of right mental attitude than it is education. Carnegie, that is my contention exactly. Not all the education a man can acquire in a lifetime can take the place of definite, decisive action. If one's thinking does not produce that sort of action, then you may be sure his thinking is not organized. Organized thought is something like the water in a dam. Only that portion of the water which is harnessed and directed over the wheel is beneficial. The water that pours aimlessly over the dam turns no wheels, performs no service. It just drifts back to the sea. Every man has a reservoir of thought power, but most men allow this power to be dissipated through idle dreaming, never taking the time to harness it and direct it toward definite ends. Like the water in a dam, it pours over the dam, dissipating its power without performing any service. Hill. Why, Mr. Carnegie, do so few men learn to harness and use their thought power? From all you have said about organized thinking, I see nothing difficult about it, but there must be some fundamental reason why the vast majority of the people go through life in poverty and misery without using the power that would give them everything they need or desire. Carnegie, there is but one major reason for this, and I can state it in one sentence: lack of definiteness of purpose. Most people drift through life, accepting whatever they can get without drawing on the forces of their minds. Lack of a definite major purpose is the most deadly form of self-limitation. It has been plainly written in the records of men that all who demand something definite find ways and means of getting it if they persist in their demands. An important part of persistence is action, the sort of action I have been talking about. Action in making a start. Action in keeping on going, even when the going is hard. Action in making a new start when one is temporarily defeated. Action, action, action. Let that word burn itself into your consciousness until it stands out like the shining sun on a cloudless day. What you are, what you become, what you acquire, all are the results of your action. Thinking, education, knowledge, native ability, opportunity are nothing but empty words unless they are translated into action. Remember this, and emphasize it throughout the philosophy of individual achievement. Never allow any student of this philosophy to pass under your influence without having the word action burned into his consciousness, for it is one of the key words of the entire philosophy. The man who leads the entire sales organization of one of the largest life insurance companies is one of the youngest men on the staff. He has been selling life insurance less than one-fourth the time that other salesmen have worked for the company. He has less personality than the majority of the other salesmen. He knows less about life insurance than many of the others, but he has one thing that gives him top position in sales production, and that is an indomitable will and a whirlwind of action which they do not possess. And here is how he expresses his action consciousness. When he makes a sale, he induces the buyer to give him a list of other prospective buyers of insurance. He also often manages to get his clients to go with him in person and introduce him to their friends. I think his superior sales record rests almost, if not entirely, upon this one action feat. You see, he forms his clients into an endless chain of cooperative effort and has, in effect, a large group of men assisting him in selling without having put them on his payroll. Hill, why do the other salesmen not profit by this man's example and do likewise? Carnegie, if I could answer that question, I would change my name from Carnegie to Solomon and set myself up as an unraveler of human problems. Your question is one that has occurred to me many times, not only in connection with this particular life insurance salesman and his fellow salesmen, but also in relation to my own organization. It is a well-known fact that certain of my associate workers have risen from the ranks of the humblest sort of labor we perform and have become principals in the business. The methods by which they promoted themselves are well known to every worker. The major principle that has entered into their promotion is that of going the extra mile. Yet the percentage of men who have chosen to promote themselves by this simple procedure has been negligible. In the final analysis, it all goes back to that principle of definiteness of purpose. The life insurance salesman sells more insurance than any of the others because he wills to do so. That is his definite major purpose, and he works at it incessantly. The others work with less willpower, with less definiteness of purpose. Why they do this is something which even they probably cannot explain. They simply lack the necessary urge. Their desires are less obsessional. Hill. From your remarks, I conceive that self-discipline is an important factor in a man's achievements. Carnegie. Of course. The life insurance salesman who leads the entire staff disciplines himself through definitely established habits of action. He makes calls when other salesmen play golf. He sells life insurance when other salesmen are asleep. He has his time definitely budgeted, and he follows the budget schedule with strict self-discipline. I can tell you this, although I have never seen the man. And I can tell you another important fact concerning him. He has made the business of selling life insurance an obsession. I doubt not that his subconscious mind goes right on selling insurance while he is asleep, for I have heard it said that on one occasion he got out of bed late at night and telephoned a prospective buyer of insurance, asking for the privilege of conveying the prospect to a convention he knew the prospect desired to attend the next morning. He said nothing about selling life insurance, but he had that ultimate end definitely in mind. Rendering his prospective buyer a favor was but the first step of a definite plan to sell him insurance. You see, when a man charges his mind with this sort of an obsession, his subconscious mind takes over his obsession and aids him in translating it into its physical or financial equivalent. Hill. Obsessional desire, then, is also an important part of organized thinking. Carnegie. Yes, a very important part. As a matter of fact, it is the part which starts action and keeps action going. A man has no difficulty in doing that which he desires to do. Obsessional desire comes to a man's rescue in times of defeat, through unforeseen emergencies, and aids him in making a new start without the loss of confidence in himself. It keeps him moving when otherwise he would yield to the habit of procrastination. It takes the drudgery out of his labor. Hill. And this brings us back again to the question of mental attitude based on motive. Obsessional desire is a mental attitude one can acquire if one has a definite motive back of the desire. Is that the idea? Carnegie. You've stated it perfectly. Mental attitude represents the sum total of one's emotional feelings at any given time. Through self-discipline, a man can determine which of his emotions will have the fullest expression and which of them will be modified, controlled, and redirected through transmutation. Mental attitude is controlled through established habits based on definite motives. Here again enters the question of action. Habits of control over mental attitude can be established only by appropriate expression of the emotions through physical action. Hill. Suppose a man is lacking in ambition and has a weak imagination,